This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, sitting in for Jane Lindholm. Since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act 26 years ago, the country has come a long way in making public spaces more accessible. Think wheelchair ramps on sidewalks, elevator signs in Braille, and walk signs at traffic lights that beep or chirp. As just a few examples, things aren't perfect by any means, but they're better. Yet while the internet is a highly trafficked public space, we don't think of it as needing to be accessible to everyone. Why? The original version of the ADA didn't specifically include the web, but the U.S. Department of Justice has made it clear that it interprets the law as applicable to the web, and it's taken steps to prohibit discrimination there. Nonetheless, many internet sites remain hard to use for those with vision problems, those with hearing loss who need closed captioning, or those who can't manipulate a mouse. How to make sites completely accessible, however, remains unclear, and the law as it stands now is hard to enforce. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll talk about the challenges web designers face in making the digital world accessible, what people with disabilities want and need to better use the web, and what several Vermont companies are doing to help. First, though, let's talk more about the law that's pushing these efforts to the forefront. Nicholas Karest is civil chief of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Vermont, and he joins us by phone from his office in Burlington. Nicholas Karest, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Nina.
So I have to say, I am fascinated by this whole topic and surprised and somewhat embarrassed that it really hadn't occurred to me that the digital world might not be as accessible as it needs to be. So how did this issue first come to the Justice Department's attention?
Well, I think it came to the Justice Department's attention, you know, sort of the same way it came to your attention, except earlier. The ADA was written in the early 90s and didn't, as you said, didn't explicitly include websites for obvious reasons. But the ADA was enacted, and Congress made clear that it should keep pace with rapidly changing parts of our world, including technology. And so from DOJ's perspective, that includes websites, because without including websites, then people with disabilities would be excluded and segregated from American life, which is the purpose of the ADA, to prevent that from happening.
So what legal cases have shaped this issue?
Well, there's been a number of legal cases around the country. And the holdings in those cases have been somewhat all over the map. But the general trend is definitely towards including websites as what we call a place of public accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act, meaning that websites are covered by the requirements of the ADA. The case law is somewhat all over the place, but definitely trending towards including websites. There's a case from Vermont from last year, March of 2015, in which one of our federal district court judges interpreted all of that case law and the statute and ruled that websites are places of public accommodation under the ADA.
What did that particular case have to do with?
So that case was brought by the National Federation of the Blind against a website that you might be familiar with called Scribd. You see it sometimes on newspaper websites. It's basically a website that collects documents and makes them available for other people to read. And the problem there was that Scribd software was not programmed to work with screen reader software that people who are blind use to use computers. And the plaintiffs in that case alleged that Scribd was violating the ADA. Judge Sessions did a thorough job of looking at all the case law and the statute itself, and ruled that that websites are included under the definition of a public accommodation under Title III of the ADA.
You mentioned, not to interrupt, you mentioned that the cases have sort of been all over the map on this issue. The Vermont case that you just talked about ruled for the person that brought the suit. Have other cases, ruled in favor of a website, say, that it didn't need to meet?
Yes, the if I can break it down into some categories, the way it breaks out is some courts have ruled that that in order to qualify as a place of public accommodation under Title III, the website has to be somehow connected to a bricks and mortar business, and other courts have ruled that website services just don't qualify. And then other courts, like our federal district court here in Vermont, and the federal district court in Massachusetts in a case involving Netflix, have ruled that websites are places of public accommodation under the definition in the ADA. So that's sort of how it breaks down. Some courts look at it and say, well, is this website providing services that are connected to a business that also has a physical location? And if so, it will count. Others have said that doesn't matter. And some courts have even said that websites just don't count no matter what. But that's definitely that view is on the way out, I would say. It's definitely not DOJ's view. And the case law is trending towards including websites as they become more and more and more part of our everyday life.
Well, it just as a final question, it sounds like this is really difficult. These are difficult laws and standards to enforce.
Yeah, they are, although DOJ relies on an industry standard, which is called the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0. And those guidelines, you know, they exist and they're possible to look at and compare to a particular website and figure out where it meets those requirements and where it doesn't. And that's where, you know, the consultants who are experts in that area and come in and are able to guide businesses towards meeting these requirements.
Well, we'll be following this as it develops. I'm sure we're going to see a lot more court cases and this whole issue develop. Nicholas, thanks very much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Nina.
Nicholas Karest heads up the Civil Division for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Vermont. And I want to bring in some other perspectives now to our conversation. Peter Jewett is the owner and partner of Accessible Web. He's also the founder of Burlington Bytes. That's a website design company. And Peter, thanks for being on the program today.
Great being here.
Josh Coffey is the co-founder and president of Easy Tactile Graphics. That's a company that makes tactile drawing tools to improve access to digital graphics for the blind and low vision community. And Josh, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Peter Jewett, let me start with you. As a web designer, we heard in just the previous few minutes about some of the legal stances. From a web designer point of view, help us understand some of the problems people with disabilities might face when they try to navigate a site, and how did you become aware of those problems?
Yeah, I mean, I became aware when I was showing my mother-in-law, who's had some slowly degenerating vision issues, I was showing her some of the websites we'd made at Burlington Bytes and became aware that text was too small for her to read, blue links were impossible for her to see. And just watch kind of the strategies and the tools she'd been using to try to make a website work for herself. And it was a real cumbersome process for her because every website's different. So at that point, I just started digging in and looking at what tools are out there, what screen readers are out there. And so depending on the disability, people use screen readers that will parse through the DOM of a website and find the navigation, find the content. People sometimes can't use a mouse, so they'll have to use a tab key or a modified keyboard to navigate through a website. Or there's videos on a website and they can't hear the text, and so without closed captioning, that video content's unavailable. So like Nicholas said, there is a standard called the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. It's put out by the W3C, the Worldwide Web Consortium. And it's real easy for people to check their own websites using a tool called the Wave Scanner that's just a Chrome plugin. So you can see what various alerts and errors you have there. But it's a big issue, so it's enough that we've spun up Accessible Web to focus on this because it's emerging as a legal issue and also a pretty massive ethical issue for businesses and organizations.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about new efforts to make websites and the internet more user-friendly for those with disabilities. Imagine trying to surf the web if you can't see or hear, or maybe your hands shake, or you can't grasp or move a mouse. The ADA's stance on web accessibility is kind of murky, but recent court cases have shown the law siding with the disabled and pushing companies to do more to make their sites available to everyone. We'd like to hear from you, listeners, if these are issues that you're dealing with on a daily basis. Maybe you have a particular disability and you think maybe you've got an answer or a complaint, or this is something that resonates with you. 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call to join our conversation. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page. Josh Coffey, your company designs products to help people who are blind or have limited vision to draw and share what they draw with others who may not be able to see. And from pictures on your website, these devices reminded me kind of a three-dimensional Etch-a-Sketches of childhood. You're nodding, so you hear that a lot. Explain how your sketch pads work and how people are using them.
So our sketch pads are essentially the equivalent of pencil and eraser drawing for blind and low vision users. How they work is a user takes a sketch pad, they put a tactile drawing sheet into it, and then with a little bit of pressure, they draw, and in real time, raised lines appear beneath their fingertips. So it's the drawing equivalent of Braille, meaning a communication form that you can feel as opposed to see, as the entire sighted world does.
Is this something that you could see eventually ending up on a computer notebook? I mean, having, you know, future models of an iPad Touch actually being touchable, where there's some tactile interface with users?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because a lot of entities out there, a lot of companies, actually Disney has a huge research effort in tactile or haptic interfaces for common tablet or smartphone devices. Our company was started 5 years ago, and we focused more on the hard copy. There was a couple reasons for that, namely the haptic devices, that real-time tactile generation from a digital source, isn't really there for consumer products yet. Either it's too expensive, or it's still in the research and development phase, or the graphics quality or the tactile sensations you get aren't high enough resolution to really get graphical information from that. So for that reason, we focused on a hard copy, if you will, medium, that allows users to actually use these tactile drawing sheets and create real tactile hard copy graphics.
How expensive are your devices?
Our Intact Sketchpad, which is the drawing tablet, is $125. For the equivalent to pencil and paper, that seems very expensive to most people in the sighted community or people that don't necessarily know about low vision or blindness. But typically, because we're serving such a small market, these technologies end up being a little bit more expensive. That said, we have heard time and time again that our products are at the right price point for parents of blind children and for blind students in high school and college to be able to afford them.
And developing this particular product, I'm sure you've started doing a lot more research, not only for folks that have visual disabilities, but all sorts of different disabilities and their use of the web and just computer technology in general. You're nodding. So when we talk about accessibility on the web and digital accessibility, where do you see this going? How big of an issue is this?
I mean, it's an enormous issue, not just for blind people, for people, as you mentioned, with motor disabilities or other cognitive disabilities. The web has become the medium for gathering information, for getting products and services from not only corporations, but also government entities. You see government programs that are largely administered through web interfaces. So making sure that blind users and users with other disabilities have access to that information, that they have access to those services, it's really imperative, because I'd say we're moving towards a digital age. We're already in a digital age. And if certain users are omitted from products or services from corporations, or especially government programs, whether it's federal, state, or local, that's a big disservice to the people in those disability groups.
Peter Jewett, I want to ask you, since you've actually created this whole separate sideline business to help companies revamp websites and make them more accessible, what are some of the issues that you're hearing from people? We've talked about visual issues, but what other disabilities are affecting the way people search on the web, and how are you trying to overcome those? Give us a practical sort of a, you know, someone came and complained about this.
It's difficult to pinpoint one specific issue. And so the WCAG standards say that a website needs to be perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust. So people need to be able to view it, they need to be able to use it, and it needs to be organized in a way that is clear to them how the content's structured and outlined. So that's the real trick, is trying to make the web for everyone. It's not trying to target one specific disability. It's trying to make it so that literally anyone can show up on your website and use it. So WCAG has three levels of compliance. There's single A, double A, and triple A. And for businesses and organizations, there's a cost benefit that is always run in how far are you going to go with this. Triple A is the ideal, and you know, as Accessible Web, we always try to push our clients towards triple A compliance and, you know, open it up to as many people as possible. But there are times when you need to make compromises and end up at single A or double A.
And who's grading? How do you figure out if a website meets those standards?
Yeah, so we have a couple things. We use the Web AIM tool, the Wave Scanner, to just scan the site technically and see, do all images have alt tags? Are there contrast errors? Stuff like that that are technical of nature. But we also have found that we need to do usability testing, because there's some stuff like how does the navigation work with a tab key instead of using a mouse? Can you move through the navigation and find the content? Are there features built in? Can you tab and hit a skip to content link so that a user doesn't have to skip through all the navigation on every page? So there's just a variety of stuff, but it's a combination of usability. You know, imagine sitting at a computer with your eyes closed and what that would be like. Or imagine if you can't use a mouse. And then there's just also a plethora of technical issues that our developers need to dig into and solve.
So listeners, we welcome your comments today. We're talking about digital accessibility, how you can navigate around the web, say, if you can't see, if, as we just talked about, you can't use a mouse. 1-800-639-2211 is our number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Maybe this is an issue that you've been dealing with. We'd like to hear from you. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So many people with disabilities already have special software, special tools they're using. We've talked about screen reading devices, software that will read the text, or things that might provide captioning for a video or something like that. But I've often heard that those can be kind of clunky, depending on what website. I read an article where a blind woman was quoted as saying, she was using screen reading software to read a news article, but that software also read all the advertisements and the graphics that were right in the middle of the article that a sighted person would just simply skim over. And I was thinking, wow, that's a drag. That is no fun. So do these specialized software programs need to be improved, or is it that the websites need to have coding that works with them in a better way? Peter Jewett, let me ask you.
Yeah, it really needs to be done in tandem. The screen readers and the adaptive technologies, they're evolving over time, and companies like Google, IBM, they've got teams that are focused on this. And it's also up to the website owner. So there's some tags in HTML5 called ARIA that control what a screen reader sees. And so my recommendation for a site with advertisements in the middle of an article would be to hide those advertisements for people with screen readers, because they're really not needed and they're going to ruin the flow of the content. So that's just kind of one of the technical recommendations. And that's why you need to use a combination of tools like the Wave Scanner and actually watch someone try to navigate the website.
Well, let's take a couple calls now. Let's talk with Brian, who is calling from Montreal. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm a volunteer with blind associations, people who are totally or very, very close to totally blind, who still need to access things through the net. And one of the biggest things that makes me angry when I talk to them, because I'm sighted, is that they get sold packages on the net, packages of web access or net access, that are multi-megabytes web bandwidth capacity, and they don't need that. And yet they can't buy small enough packages, and they can't trim down all the video and other high bandwidth content that is completely inaccessible. Is that a problem you encounter when you're trying to serve Americans?
Interesting question. Brian, let me throw that to either Peter. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Are you talking about the amount of bandwidth, like in their internet package that they're receiving? Or?
Yeah, you literally can't buy packages in the right range for their data needs. You know, you buy hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes per month of access, and you can't buy smaller ones, and it's all concast under net neutrality. Well, we all have the right to this vast torrent of data. But what it means is we're all paying for data that these blind people and other specialty users literally don't need to pay for.
All right. Thanks for the call. Did that clarify? Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, I think I can address this. And that's, you know, it's an important issue that you're raising. But I think one thing that you want to avoid is the separate but equal mentality in terms of web access. So it's unfortunate that there aren't smaller internet packages out there with blind users consuming less video information, obviously. But, you know, people like Peter and people around the country right now are working on making videos accessible with audio narration. So to limit the internet bandwidth that users have almost creates a scenario where you're creating websites just for blind people. And then you need to ask yourself the question, is all the information there? Are they getting full access to the services, information, and products that they're trying to gain access to through the internet? So I do appreciate what you're saying. And I think it's an interesting question in terms of blind users' usage of bandwidth and, you know, not necessarily needing as much. But to create a separate category for their internet usage could create a problem in having these kind of separate but equal approaches to websites. And I don't think that's what the blind community is looking for right now.
We're talking about new efforts to make websites and the internet more user-friendly for those with disabilities. It's an issue that's been slow to catch on, but maybe gaining steam. Listeners, you can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or at vpr.net. We'll get to more of your questions and get a first-hand perspective on this issue from a representative of the National Federation for the Blind. That's after we take a short break. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, sitting in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today about accessibility, not in physical buildings, but on the web. What are some of the challenges people with disabilities encounter when they navigate websites, and how are web designers trying to overcome them? My guests today are Peter Jewett and Josh Coffey. Peter Jewett is the owner and partner of Accessible Web and the founder of Burlington Bytes. That's a website design company. Josh Coffey is the co-founder and president of Easy Tactile Graphics. It's a company that makes tactile drawing tools to improve access to digital graphics for the blind and low vision community. Listeners, are there problems you encounter when you're on the web? Are some of the accessibility issues we've talked about today things you deal with? You can talk to us about it by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Anil Lewis joins us by phone now. He's the executive director of the National Federation for the Blind, Jernigan Institute. Anil, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Nina, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Website guidelines concerning accessibility have been around since at least 2008, but as we've been hearing today, compliance has been kind of slow. Mm-hmm. How frustrating is that for you?
It's extremely frustrating. I mean, the web is supposed to be that even playing field that allows me as a blind person to be competitive with my sighted peers, and I'm glad that the previous participants have talked about the technicality, because I'd like to stress something I think that gets overlooked. People continue to think that making the web accessible is an extra additional burden. And I just want them to focus on the fact that by making the website accessible to blind individuals, you make it accessible or more accessible to everyone. The tools that are required to make a website accessible don't necessarily make it easier for me as a blind person to use it solely. Those tools also make it easier for deaf individuals, people, as I believe Peter was saying, with other disabilities, but even beyond that, people without disabilities. You see a lot of the interfaces that people with disabilities have used to interact with technology, especially speaking to technology. Non-disabled people are using it. Look at the ways that people are talking to their devices now to get things to work. So we're saying that by leveraging our needs for access, you're actually enhancing the ability for everyone to take advantage of the service.
My guests are both nodding. And according to the Census Bureau surveys, I mean, we're not talking about small numbers of people. Nearly one in five Americans reported having a disability in 2010.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of folks being affected by this. As someone who's blind, could you talk about how you use your computer and other electronic devices? What tools do you use to navigate?
Absolutely. I mean, one highlight I want to stress as I move into this is that the National Federation of the Blind is an organization of blind people, and I think that's key because so far the people who participated have been, sighted individuals that are wanting to help us. And first, to dismiss a couple of things, the statement around the advertisement in the middle of the reading. It is an inconvenience, but developing software that ignores the advertising is not necessarily what a blind person would necessarily want. Suppose that advertisement is the information I'm trying to access. So I think that the true answer to that is to give the blind person the choice. So I can navigate through those spaces by using my screen reader to jump over different chunks. So when I get to an advertisement, just like you would visually, just look over it, I can issue a keystroke that will jump over that chunk of advertising data to the next chunk of text for the article.
But you're saying it's important that it's your choice to do that.
Exactly. And that's why we have to make sure that the blind individual actually knows how to use their technology in a way that makes them effective. And then the other gentleman related to the bandwidth, I'm glad that Peter and both Josh chimed in. I think the answer is not to create a space where we can get a smaller data footprint, but make sure that that data that everyone else needs to have access to get that content is made accessible. So making sure that rather than not getting access to the video on a smaller data field, I want access to the video. Believe it or not, there are blind individuals out there that are actually gaming. You know the video games? They're blind guys that can do that, and they're very competitive, too. So to answer your question, technology is in everything, just like in everybody else's life. As an executive director here at the Institute, my computer talks. Let me see if I can. So that's my computer talking. You notice that the speed is very quickly because I like to hear the information as quickly as a sighted person could read it. I use the web to do everything from manage the payroll system and the attendance system for my staff, to do research for the projects that we're doing, to anything you would use it, to making purchases. As a matter of fact, I just made a donation to a school for their beginning of the year by going to the Target website and purchasing some items for school kids to start school. So the same way you would use it, it's the same way I would like to use it.
Well, and
unfortunately, go ahead.
I like that you just showed that you could speed that up. You know, you're a fast reader. You can kind of dial in and adjust as you need it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's all about making sure that the functionality of the intervention meets the need of the individual that's using it.
So what's the National Federation of the Blind doing to push these efforts along? How is your organization lobbying and try to get the word out that this is important not only for your members but for Americans everywhere?
Exactly. I think that a good example I like to point out is, I forget the gentleman's name who's with OCR at the top of the show. He talked about how under ADA, right now it's kind of case law that if they have a physical brick-and-mortar space, then their website has to be accessible. We were kind of forerunners in making that actual law. We had a relationship with Target in the beginning where we were trying to make sure that their website was accessible. They had inaccessibility around a lot of different things, even to the point where if you wanted to purchase something, you click on the Buy Now button and nothing would happen. So I don't know why they would want to turn down my money. But in the beginning, it wasn't a friendly relationship. We really were very assertive, and we did take legal action. And we, I think, were kind of the catalyst for establishing case law around the brick-and-mortar solution. But to show the win-win, Target and the National Federation of the Blind are true partners there. They're our first strategic non-visual access partner, meaning we're not trying to make people think that we're making them do something. We're really trying to show them the benefit of it. Now, we'll resort to legal action if we need to, but we've seen that it's much better to develop that partnership. We can show them, as I believe Peter was saying, the cost benefit. So now Target not only meets, you know, YCAG 2.0A or AA, I think that they're moving in that AAA space. And they are doing accessibility the way it should be done. Because some people say, well, we'll create the website, then we'll make the website accessible. No, you have to enculturate accessibility. Your developers need to know how to code accessibly like they would just learn to code generally.
Mm-hmm.
Your executives need to be committed to making sure that the platform is accessible to blind individuals because, like I said, it makes it a better website for everyone to use. So that's what we're focusing on. We're developing those partnerships. We're showing people how it can be done. We're expanding and enhancing their cost-benefit analysis in those areas where they haven't really considered the benefit. And if necessary, we will litigate. Okay. That's not our preference, but we are committed to serving our 50,000-plus members across the country and making sure that blind people, you know, throughout the country can be competitive and access the information just like anyone else.
Well, Anil Lewis, thank you very much.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I did a little research. This Vermont edition, this is awesome. The variety of topics you guys cover is amazing. So I appreciate this being one of those topics.
Well,
and, can I give one quick thing? The
yeah.
National Federation of the Blind of Vermont will be having their state convention there. So if you want to come and help us make a change in the world, it's going to be in either probably Burlington at the way we're going on October 29th. And we'll be getting more information out. Maybe we'll share it with you, and maybe you can let your listeners know.
Well, all the best. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Anil Lewis is with the National Federation for the Blind. I want to go back to the phone lines now. We've got a couple of folks that have been waiting to call in. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Middlebury. Hi, Richard. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My background is I'm an architect, and I work a lot with the American Disabilities Act whenever I do drawings for schools, hotels, hospitals, restaurants, whatever it might be. And I noticed with some of the biggest name architects, they actually do not follow the specifications because of cost-cutting that the contractor is saving for himself. But in talking about the deaf and the blind, my aunt is deaf, and she was given to me to go to meetings because she could read people's lips and then write out what they were talking about. But the other way is when you go to a program, for example, Japanese or some language you don't know, there's subtitles for people who can't hear. So you can read the subtitles and know what's going on. Otherwise, you could, if you're blind, you could hear it, like for Wikipedia.
Richard,
on the voice.
Richard, I think we've got it. I think you're talking about traditional ADA requirements, which are part of our discussion today, but we're talking more about digital ADA requirements and how websites and the net are trying to become more accessible. Let's take another call right now. Let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Barrie. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. Yeah, as a web developer and someone who specializes specifically in search engine optimization, I did want to point out that when you make websites accessible to people who are blind or have disabilities, you also make the website more accessible to search engines and to other web crawlers, which ultimately benefits the company or the website even more in the long run.
Thanks for the call. I'm curious, just in the few minutes we have left, talking about how this is going to move forward and what companies can do to be more proactive. Peter Jote, what would you say to companies out there that are wondering, how accessible is my website and what should I be doing? And maybe how much should I expect to pay to upgrade my website?
Yeah, I would say to start, use the Wave Scanner and see what issues there are. And if you've got an internal web team, that it may very well be something that your developers can do on their own. In Accessible Web, we always do free consultations, so don't hesitate to reach out if you have questions or if you want to do a couple rounds of usability testing to see how accessible your website is. The cost is a difficult thing to tie down. You know, it ranges anywhere from like $5,000 to there really is no upper limit. If you look at a website like Vermont Edition that has thousands and thousands of stories on it, each story needs to be updated. So each image that's associated with each story would need an alt tag on it. So the thing with WCAG compliance is that the whole site needs to be compliant. One failure will fail the entire website. So the cost really depends on the complexity and size of the site.
Well, I think this is a discussion we're going to be talking about a lot more in the coming years as this all evolves. And I'm chagrined to say, again, that I really had no idea, though it sounds like it is definitely going to be a wave that's coming. Josh Coffey is the co-founder and president of Easy Tactile Graphics. That's a company that makes tactile drawing tools for the blind and low vision community. Josh, I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Jewett is the owner and partner of Accessible Web. He's also the founder of Burlington Bytes, a website design company. And Peter, thank you for being on the program today.
Yeah, and if I can just close by saying we are just starting. And so anyone in this community that's been living or working with a disability, definitely reach out, accessibleweb.com, get in touch.
Still to come, if you love the soulful call of the loon, well, you're not alone. That sound and the water birds that make it are being increasingly threatened. We'll talk with a biologist about why and what's being done in our region to protect loons. Stay with us. That's ahead on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. Okay, pop quiz time. Listeners, what's this sound? Okay, if you said a pair of loons calling to each other, you win the prize. If you said wolves or something else, wrong answer. While the haunting call echoes across many lakes in the region, it is not guaranteed to be something that you'll always be able to hear. The loon population has rebounded somewhat recently, but the birds are still at risk from many factors. One of the biggest threats? Lead poisoning. Well, several states have adopted laws banning certain types of lead fishing tackle meant to protect loons. The problem remains. Harry S. Fogle joins me by phone to talk about the issue and how loons are doing across New England. He's executive director and senior biologist at the Loon Preservation Committee based in New Hampshire. Harry Fogle, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So first of all, give us a quick introduction as to what sort of birds loons are and where they live.
Sure. So loons are water birds. They are not ducks. One of the fastest ways to really annoy a loon researcher is to call them ducks or waterfowl. They're actually more closely related to the penguins and the tube-nosed swimmers, which are the albatrosses, the petrels, and the shearwaters. And so they split their time between freshwater lakes during the breeding season and the Atlantic Ocean during the winter.
So most of us have heard that amazing call, and I want to talk about those loon calls for a minute or so. There are a few different kinds that you'll hear, the wail, like the one we played at the top of the segment, and then there's that distinctive laughing sound. Let's take a listen to that. So do scientists know what those different calls mean?
We think we have a pretty good idea of what those mean. So, for instance, the whale call that you had played at the beginning of this segment is often given when loons who are sleeping on their territory, and unless they're sitting on a nest, loons will always sleep on the water of their territory. And so a mated pair of loons will be sleeping over the course of the evening. They will drift away from each other. One or the other will wake up, and they will give that whale call. That wakes up its mate, and its mate then gives that return call, and they come towards each other. So from those actions, from those behaviors, we infer that a whale means, here I am, where are you, and come closer.
And what about that laughing sound that we just heard?
Yes, so the tremolo is actually an alarm call for loons. So anything that causes a loon distress, you may hear that tremolo call. But sometimes in the morning, if you're out on the lake, some people will say, oh my goodness, I heard the loons tremoloing and something terrible must have happened. It's not always the case because the tremolo is also the most dramatic statement of territory ownership that a female loon can make. And so sometimes male and female loons will kind of antiphonally call back and forth, tremoloing in the night, and that is essentially advertising territorial ownership of that body of water by a pair of loons.
Those calls are so dramatic when you're on a lake and you hear them. I love to hear those calls.
Absolutely.
So how are loons doing across New England? I know it differs state by state and even region by region, but how are they doing right now in the New Hampshire-Vermont area?
Yeah. Well, in New Hampshire, I would describe the population as stable to increasing. In Vermont, loons are doing better. So they are actually growing at a good clip. But they're doing that with a lot of help from an interested public and from organizations like Loon Preservation Committee here in New Hampshire and the Vermont Loon Recovery Program, which is a great program of Vermont Center for Eco Studies in Vermont. And so we do a combination of things to help out these loons. And so we're doing monitoring to assess the state of that population. So I like to say that our work begins and ends by counting loons, because counting those birds gives us our first indication of problems with the population, and it's also the ultimate measure of our success in keeping these birds common. Then we do research to assess and dig into some of those threats and ways in which we can mitigate those threats, and we put that research to use in focused management, and that includes floating loon nesting rafts to help loons that have been displaced from shoreline development, or loons on lakes that have rapidly changing water levels, because these rafts float, so they go up and down as water levels float. And then we also work to protect nesting pairs of loons through putting up signs and rope lines. And in especially in New Hampshire, and even more so in Vermont, loons are very intensively managed. And so the success that we've had has really relied on the management and the education and kind of a comprehensive conservation program that has been at work for many, many years in both of those states.
Well, I want to jump to lead poisoning, because I was surprised to read that that is a major threat right now to loons. And explain why that is.
Yeah. So from banding loons, and this is part of that research again, from banding these loons to so that we can recognize individuals and track individuals over their lifetimes, we've learned many things about the natural history of loons that turn out to be really important. And so one thing that surprised us was to learn that loons don't begin to breed on average until they're 6 years old. And then, of course, after that, they have a maximum. They'll lay a maximum of 2 eggs. And in New Hampshire and in Vermont, typically a loon pair will have a chick every second year that actually survives to fledge from the lake.
Wow!
And so, any animal that has those life history characteristics—a delayed age at first breeding and then essentially very poor reproductive success—the key to maintaining a viable population of that animal is to keep those birds alive from year to year, so that they have many opportunities over their lifetime to breed. And so anything that is affecting adult mortality of loons is something that we take very seriously, and you don't need to go very much further than lead sinkers and lead-headed jigs, because in New Hampshire, that fishing tackle, lead fishing tackle, is responsible for close to half of the documented adult loon mortality that we see. And in Vermont, I think it is also approaching that level.
So they eat the lead sinkers, and then the lead dissolves in their system and kills them, poisons them?
Absolutely. Because loons have no teeth, so they need to swallow their food whole. And then after that, they forage along the lake bottom for these little pebbles. And they ingest those pebbles. They hold that in the gizzard, the muscular portion of their stomach, and the grinding action of those rocks. So those act as surrogate teeth to grind up the fish that they have just eaten. The problem is that every once in a while, a loon can mistake one of a lead split shot sinker, so these really small split shots, for one of those pebbles that they're ingesting. So that's one way in which loons can swallow a lead sinker. There are two other ways, though, and we've actually found that these are more common. One is that the typical prey item for a loon might be a 4 to 8 inch yellow perch, but loons will on occasion swallow much larger fish. And when you get into fish that are larger than that 8 inch yellow perch, you're talking about a fish that could conceivably break an angler's line. And when they break that line, they're going to be trailing still a length of line and a lead sinker or a lead-headed jig. And when a loon gets that fish, it also gets the sinker or the jig.
Well, very briefly, I want to ask you about laws that have been passed to ban lead shots or lead sinkers, and what sort of impact have they had?
Yeah. So New Hampshire actually became the first state in the nation to ban certain sizes of lead sinkers and lead-headed jigs. And it has been a gradual process. So the initial legislation dealt with only the sinkers and very, very small lead-headed jigs. Since then, we have introduced successive pieces of legislation to build on that standard to arrive at what we feel is a protective standard for loons. And so the legislation that is in effect in New Hampshire as of today restricts the sale and use of lead sinkers and lead-headed jigs of 1 ounce or less in weight. And we feel that that's a protective standard. In Vermont, I believe that it's sinkers of a half an ounce or less, and no legislation really on lead-headed jigs. Mm-hmm. And here in New Hampshire, we found that those lead-headed jigs are responsible for more than half of the lead poisonings in the state. And so we would love to see a more protective standard in Vermont, as well as in Maine and Massachusetts and in New York as well, where there are still some decent populations of loons, and we would like to keep it that way.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us about loons. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's an important issue. Thanks for your interest.
That was Harry Vogel, Senior Biologist and Executive Director of New Hampshire's Loon Preservation Committee. If you want to know more about loons in Vermont, the Vermont Center for Eco Studies operates the Vermont Loon Conservation Project, headed up by loon biologist Eric Hansen, who's been working for years to preserve and protect the state's loons. There's a link to their website on our show page at vpr.net. And that's it for today's program. Tomorrow, with a tricky job market and college tuitions at daunting levels, career and technical education programs may be looking more and more appealing. On the next Vermont Edition, we'll talk about career and technical education in our state, what it looks like, and who's choosing that option. Send your questions and comments to us at vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Gene Murphy. Alex Keefe directed the program today. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.